Welcome to the Sanity Interview by the New York Sun. My name is A.R. Hoffman, and every week, along with my co-host Rebecca Sugar, we speak to the people that you want to hear from.
We're joined today by Ben Habib. Ben is a British businessman and politician. He moved to the UK from Karachi, Pakistan at the age of 13. Mr. Habib graduated from Cambridge University, spent his early career in finance, and then moved to private property development and investment. Mr. Habib entered politics in 2019, joining the Brexit Party, and was elected a member of the European Parliament until the UK left the EU in 2020. He joined Reform UK in March 2023, becoming its deputy leader. He later resigned from Reform and established Advance UK in June of 25, and he's won an endorsement by Elon Musk. Advance seeks to rebuild a proud, sovereign, and prosperous United Kingdom. So thank you so much for being here, Mr. Habib.
It's a pleasure. Please call me Ben.
I will.
Thank you very much for having me on.
If you become Prime Minister, I'm going to say that I called you Ben.
Yeah, and I would insist you continue to call me Ben.
Excellent.
Ben at 10 Downing.
Yeah. Ben at 10.
Yeah.
It goes,
yeah. So I wanted to start, because Brexit seems to have inspired your move into politics, I wanted to start with this notion of British sovereignty. And there was a quote on your website, one of the sort of principles that Advance UK stands for, I wanted to read. It says, quote, "The party promotes and celebrates the nation's Christian constitution, roots, tradition, culture, and values." I really am interested in this idea of reaffirming your country's Christian identity. I think here in the United States, we're grappling with this right now for many of the same reasons, actually. So I wondered if you could just talk about that principle. What do you mean by that? And what are the Christian foundations of Britain that you want to reassert, and how will they help your country?
So it's no accident, I think, that the United Kingdom, if it's no longer the greatest country in the world, it's certainly one of the best countries in the world. And it was, for hundreds of years, one of the greatest countries in the world. And in my mind, part of the reason it was so great was to do with the fact that it was a Christian country, that the form of religion that was practiced in this country was one that was forgiving, kind, patrician, but nevertheless encouraging of people to go forth, spread their wings, make the best they can out of their own lives. We managed to establish not just a brilliant Christian cultural setup in this country, but a brilliant constitutional setup where Christianity, whilst it absented itself from the day-to-day governance of the country, it nevertheless was embedded in the roots of our unwritten constitution. I'm sure listeners in America know we don't have a written constitution, but it embedded itself in our constitution. To the extent, of course, as I'm sure you're also aware, that the King of England is the head of our church. The King of the United Kingdom is the head of our church, and that the bishops of the United Kingdom sit in the House of Lords. It's a matter of formality that they sit there. And so what we have in the United Kingdom, what is being set aside, is the integration of church into the body of our lawmakers, as well as the what used to be our most senior decision makers, the law lords in the House of Lords. And we had a wonderful integrated parliamentary system that wasn't just the making of laws, but provided moral guidance through the House of Lords, as well as legal guidance through the House of Lords. And we've forgotten our Christian constitutional roots. I hear often people talking about our cultural roots, but that's missing the importance of the constitutional roots, which have guided this country so well for hundreds of years.
Let me ask you, Rebecca mentioned Brexit. There's so much I want to ask you about it. I mean, just even that we could talk about all day. But, you know, how do you assess the sort of Brexit project now about a decade later? Of course, Boris Johnson won the 10 Downing, saying on the get Brexit done line. Now, obviously, the Conservatives are sort of in the wilderness. Have things surprised you? Have your expectations been met, confirmed? Where does the project of Brexit stand as we talk today?
The vote to leave the European Union was a vote, in my mind, by the British people to reject the increasing influence and control of our country by the EU, but also by other supranational bodies, which have so come to, stand against nation states. Bodies like the UN, WHO, World Economic Forum, European Convention of Human Rights, many of these bodies set up in the aftermath of World War II with goodness at heart, because they didn't want the great nation states of the world to have another world war. And so a lot of these institutions were set up with good intentions, but they've morphed into something way beyond just being talking shops for the great nations of this world to air their differences and to solve their differences without having to go to war. They have become organisms in their own right. And they have started to take control, particularly the EU. I mean, the EU is the worst of the lot because it seeks to take power away from nation states and empower itself. It even tried in 2005 to have its own constitution. It has its own national anthem, and it's now moving towards having its own military. And the British people voted against all of that. They wanted governance to come back to the UK, for laws to be made in the UK, for our parliamentarians to be accountable to them rather than Brussels making our laws and being entirely unaccountable. And so it was a vote to take back control. And often Boris Johnson, apart from saying getting Brexit done, he often said, take back control, take back control. But sadly, we didn't take back control. What Boris Johnson did was pay lip service to the democratic mandate the British people gave him to leave the European Union. And instead of leaving, we signed two new treaties. We re-established a new relationship with the EU. We signed two treaties, one of which is called the Withdrawal Agreement, and the other one is called the Trade and Cooperation Agreement. And the combined effect of these two new treaties was effectively to still bind the United Kingdom to the EU in fundamental areas of law, fundamental areas of foreign policy, the way we conduct ourselves, the way we govern ourselves. And the worst aspect of it all was that we actually left part of our country behind in the European Union. Northern Ireland, for reasons I can give you if you're interested, Northern Ireland has actually very substantially been left behind in the EU, subject to dynamic alignment with EU laws, subject to EU human rights laws. And so we've become, as a result of Boris Johnson's deals, the first country, I think, ever in history to have partitioned itself without a popular demand for a partition, or without an insurgency, or without a war. We have literally put a border down between Great Britain, which is Scotland, Wales, and England on one side, and Northern Ireland on the other. We have a border down the Irish Sea. And I know that because I brought a case against the government to get the withdrawal agreement changed to the extent needed to bring Northern Ireland back into the United Kingdom. And the Supreme Court in this country ruled that actually our acts of union, which created the United Kingdom, have been breached, that Northern Ireland is now sitting on its own. It's not on an equal footing with Great Britain, but that Boris Johnson had done that legally. So Supreme Court somehow got its head around partitioning the country and claiming that it has been done legally. And I think that, without wishing to move too far ahead, that attests to a complete breakdown in the United Kingdom of its ability to actually chart a course that is sovereign for itself. If you're a country that's prepared to leave part of your country behind when you change your trading arrangements, when you change your relationship with a supranational body, you basically are not a country that is in control of your own destiny. You've taken the knee to what I call the global order. And Boris Johnson did that. So we have not fulfilled the democratic mandate to leave the EU. And Boris Johnson has thrown part of the country and indeed the entire project under a bus.
Let me just follow up. I mean, Would your answer to folks who said, listen, you know, we thought leaving the EU was going to generate this widespread prosperity, you know, that hasn't really happened economically. We thought that was going to lead to the decrease in the number of immigrants to England. That hasn't really happened. Is your argument that Brexit didn't go far enough? That's why
we didn't get it. But Brexit is binary. It's not a matter of degrees. It's binary. Are you able to make your own laws? Can you enforce those laws yourself? And can you hold your politicians to account? We can't claim in this country to do any of those things on the issues that you've just highlighted. We are not in control of our borders. It is the European Convention of Human Rights that dictates to us whether or not we can stop people from coming into our country and the mechanisms which we can use. We can't deregulate our economy and do what's right for the British economy, because under the trade and cooperation agreement that Boris Johnson signed, we are obliged to adhere to EU law on state aid, on competition, on employment, and even on climate. So, for example, we are committed entirely to the net zero project by 2050 under the trade agreement we signed with the European Union. Now, the United Kingdom, just to give you an example, the United Kingdom produces less than 1% of global carbon emissions. We are one of the really good guys when it comes to carbon emissions, if carbon emissions are a thing that worry you. And yet we are killing our economy in the pursuit of this net zero target, which is foisted on us in a number of different ways, but all centrally also as a result of the relationship we have with the EU. So when people say Brexit hasn't worked because you can't control your borders, your economy hasn't improved, you haven't deregulated, you haven't cut taxes, it's because we've signed a new damn agreement with this institution that the British people said leave, and we didn't leave. And so we can't judge it. It's binary. Have we got control or not? And the answer is we haven't.
On this issue of net zero, I just want you to talk a little bit more about the impacts to the UK, because I don't think it's talked about enough what it does to you economically in terms of you're in the commercial real estate business, what that does to that, what it does to the energy exploration and in the seas off of your, you know, coasts. And so can you just talk about why net zero is so detrimental to the economic growth of the UK?
Net zero is bad enough for you guys, but at least you're fossil fuel independent and you frack and you use the fossil fuels you've got. I know that under previous administrations, you've made an effort under the Inflation Reduction Act, for example. There was a very massive spending commitment made to renewable energy and promoting American businesses through that. But even Biden got it that you don't turn your back on fossil fuels until your renewables can actually step into the stead, into the breach that's created by the absence of fossil fuels. We did the project the other way around. We're British, and therefore we don't think these things through the way we should. And we made a commitment to net zero. And Boris Johnson, another thing for which I will never forgive him, signed something called the North Sea Transition Deal in 2023. And it basically committed our fossil fuel industry to transitioning away from fossil fuels to renewables, without renewables being able to stand up and take the place of the fossil fuel industries that we were setting aside. So we have the ridiculous situation, Rebecca, if I can call you Rebecca, where we are no longer taking gas from the North Sea, but we are importing liquefied natural gas in vast volumes from the United States of America. And with much greater carbon footprint, because to extract the gas in America, freeze it, bring it across the Atlantic, defrost it, and then put it down our pipes is a much more carbon intensive process than if we took it straight out of the North Sea and into our own usage. But net zero is much worse than us just turning our back on domestically available cheap fossil fuel. We've also, on the back of net zero, and I'm sure you're familiar with all of this, been required to upgrade all our commercial property in this country, upgrade all housing, insulate until you get mold in your own properties because you haven't got a natural draft, replace perfectly good gas boilers with extremely expensive heat exchangers, give up your perfectly good internal combustion engine cars for new electric cars at vast cost, which the average working class Brit can't afford. And so net zero has turned its back on domestically available fossil fuels, but it's made life extremely expensive in the UK. And I'm a property man, so I'm just going to give you a property example. 80% of commercial property in this country, 80% of commercial property does not comply with the 2030 targets for net zero. So 80% of property in this country either has to be retrofitted at vast cost, which will be extremely inflationary and damaging to British business, or is going to become obsolete. And in most cases, it's going to become obsolete because it's in locations where the cost can't be tolerated by tenants. We are doing huge damage on the altar of net zero.
Really interesting. I think most folks don't know all that. Let me ask you a little bit, Ben, to talk to us about the kind of contemporary British political scene. You know, from where we're sitting across the Atlantic, okay, the Conservatives were in power for a long time. You know, you had the Boris Johnson years. We kind of get that. You know, one party's in power, another party comes in. Keir Starmer was called like the Loveless Landslide, right, where like the numbers looked a lot better than the actual percentage. And then a year later, things seem just as dysfunctional, just as kind of unhappy, I would say, in the landscape. So, what's your read? How did we get here? And then I think we'll get to kind of, you know, your party and where you think your solution is. But for the moment, if you could just kind of diagnose, you know, what's the state of Britain at the moment?
So if I were to diagnose the political state, which I think is your question, I would say that we are in a constitutional crisis that started in 2016 when the biggest democratic mandate was to leave the EU. You know, it was 17.4 million people vote, 72% turnout, and 17.4 million people voted to leave the EU. And successive governments have either refused to do it or failed to do it. Starmer now is actually taking us even further back into the EU. He wants our military to be governed by Brussels, in effect. He won't admit it, but that's what he's doing. He's aligning us on sanitary and phytosanitary regulations. He's adopting the EU carbon tax system, for example. And so we've had successive governments standing against the will of the British people. And you will appreciate this, being the great democratic nation that you are, that if the people give you a mandate, you as politicians must follow it through. If you don't follow it through, you end up in opposition to the people. And we've had one constitutional crisis after another. That we are not cutting immigration, as was promised. We've got mass legal immigration, but we've also got mass illegal immigration, both forms of immigration entirely out of control. We gave our politicians a mandate to take back control in terms of their accountability, making laws for this country and so on, and they haven't done it. And we are going to go through, I think, we're going to behave like a writhing animal in pain, unable to rid itself of its pain. And we will be in this convulsed state until Parliament starts doing what the people of this country wish it to do.
I want to ask you, Ben, you know, we have a segment on our show called Sunburn every week, and where Ari and I each choose a subject that's bothering us or offending us or outraging us in the news. And for me, it's almost always about the UK. I just, what's happened to your country so bothers me, I think because I grew up going there a lot. And I always loved London in particular. I don't recognize it anymore, but nothing irritates me more than the loss of free speech across the United Kingdom. You've become something of a laughingstock across the Western world when it comes to free speech rights or the lack thereof. And I think even Elon Musk, really, the thing that pushed him to endorse you was your defense of free speech, which really matters to him. And we've had our battles with that in this country and probably continue to have them. But I just wondered, without a First Amendment, even if you became the next prime minister, what could you do to restore free speech in Britain so that it doesn't ever go away again? What can you anchor into the law? What are the guardrails you could put up that don't exist now so that you never end up in this place again?
We, as I mentioned, Rebecca, we have an unwritten, we had an unwritten constitution. We had, and I'm going to, in the past tense, we had an unwritten constitution. Tony Blair came to office and he perpetrated under the radar. I didn't appreciate it at the time. I was a young man. I was 32 years old when he came to office, and I was more interested in business than I was in politics. And but I didn't realize the dramatic revolutionary changes that he had made. Our country had, until that point, evolved very slowly, very incrementally. You might remember when you visited the UK as a young girl, that, or as a as an adolescent, that we were regarded as a kind of rock on the international geopolitical stage. We didn't go this way or that way in a hurry. We did things very sensibly and very slowly. And that was our greatest asset. And it turned on politicians behaving with the United Kingdom's best interests at heart. It turned on a series of protocols, unwritten laws, procedures that Parliament would observe, and so on. He ignored all of those, and he effectively brought a whole body of law, the new law, into the UK. He codified lots of aspects of the UK's law, which then set the UK on the path that we now find ourselves, unable to reconnect with that wonderful country that we once were. Infected by international law, particularly EU law, and making laws and governing ourselves in a way that is damaging to us. They see it as betterment of the globe, but it's actually deeply damaging to us. And part of that process that we've been on, Rebecca, if you perpetrate extreme policies against a people, if you tell them that mass migration is fine, you allow illegal migration, you pursue economic policies that are deeply damaging to the country. You set aside Christianity because you want to be a multi-faith country. If you perpetrate these extreme policies on a people, you have no option as a government other than to bear down on free speech, because otherwise the people are going to stand up against you. And so we have a ridiculous thing. You may or not have heard of it, but I'll tell you about it. Something called a non-crime hate incident. Are you familiar with this concept? So we have legislation which literally defines what a non-crime hate incident is. And it's basically speech that someone could take offense to. It's not illegal, but it's speech to which someone could take offense. And there are 12,000 interventions every year by the police, in making inquiries, following leads on non-crime hate incidents. And some of the youngest people they've consulted are 9 years old
Yes, we've
at
seen the
school.
videos of young boys, of veterans being pulled out of their wheelchairs, all sorts of videos online of
Yeah.
your so-called
So
hate speech laws in action.
to settle the United Kingdom, to go back to that rock that we once were, that stable rock which was democratic and was such a wonderful country, we have to basically repeal everything that's virtually everything that governments have done since 1997. We need to go back to a pre-Tony Blair era. We need to get rid of the codification, EU law, the Human Rights Act, the Equalities Act, which is not about making people equal, it's about progressive discrimination. We need to get rid of the Climate Change Act and all their progeny, because these acts of Parliament, which have been so damaging, have regulations and other acts of Parliament that come out of them that continue to infect us and make things worse. Like the Online Safety Act, for example, that you may have heard of, which was meant to be protecting children, but it's being used by the police, for example, to monitor X for anti-immigration statements. You know, as if being anti-immigration is somehow makes you a vile human being. Being anti-immigration isn't xenophobic. It's not racist. It is just merely wishing to put your own people first. And yet somehow we've got to the point where we need to bear down on people who are anti-immigration by shutting down their ability to speak. So we need to unpick the infection of the last 30 years of British
But just quickly to
lawmaking.
follow up, how would you prevent the next infection? Any chance that
Now,
you could have a First Amendment of some sort?
that is a very, very good question. But what we is, I'll answer that. But before we go to that stage, we must recognize that we have to undo what's been done. We have to go back to a position of stability. there's a knee-jerk propensity, I think, for people to say, well, we must have a Freedom of Speech Act. Now, if we do that Freedom of Speech Act without having unpicked everything else, all it turns out to be is a sticking plaster on a gaping wound. So my aim in Advance UK is to go back to 1996 and then, having got us to a settled position, decide what it is we need to do next incrementally and sensibly to make sure the UK doesn't fall down that same trapdoor again.
So speaking of going back and then to go to the future, you know, polls show Nigel Farage's Reform Party is leading in popularity, elections sort of coming up. I mean, are you bullish that there is going to be a kind of revolution here? I mean, will the UK join a lot of other countries in Europe and here to in this kind of dramatic, let's call it a populist pivot? I'm not sure if that's exactly the right word, but sort of right-wing shift. How do you assess kind of how this all plays out in the coming months?
Well, I mean, we pivoted as a country. We pivoted before Europe did, miles before Europe. As I say, in 2016, the British people said, no, we've had enough of this, get us out. It's the politicians who've been the impediment, not the British people. And I'm afraid reform isn't the answer. Nigel Farage carries the persona of a pro-nation, pro-British, sovereign, prosperous, proud politician. That's the kind of persona he carries. But the reality of Nigel Farage is that he is a political expedient. And that's really the reason I left Reform, having been its deputy leader. I left because he was taking on into the party all the same failed politicians, and he continues to do it. The failed politicians that got this country into the mess it's in. And he is unable, for example, to fearlessly call out the attacks on free speech. He is unable to call out accurately, because he fears it, the two-tier criminal justice system we've got. He doesn't stand up for our Christian constitution. Farage, sadly, I know you like him a lot in the States and he's seen as a friend of the Trump administration, but he's a great performer, but he doesn't really have the country's interests at heart. And I think Elon Musk saw that, which is why Elon Musk denounced Farage and subsequently endorsed this new party that I've set up. And what I do say is this, that the British people are already there. They're looking for a political party they can support, which will deliver, without fear, deliver a sovereign nation, which will make policies for the betterment of the country and its people. And my challenge in Advance is to communicate that message, the message that we are that party, to the British people.
So tell us a little bit about Advance UK and how you're getting that message across and who the constituencies are who are most receptive and how you're being received. You're quite an interesting sort of character in your own identity and your own right to be running a party like this, that, you know, an immigrant yourself and a Muslim father, a Christian mother. You sort of strike at the heart of a lot of the questions that you're trying to answer. So tell us about the party and how you're moving it forward.
So let me just quickly tell you about me first. I don't see myself as an immigrant. Perhaps other people do, but I don't see myself as an immigrant. My mother is white, blonde, Christian English lady. She married my father in 1961, moved to Pakistan. I was born in 1965 into a household which, you know, we celebrated Easter, we celebrated Christmas, we sang hymns, I went to church services and so on. And then I came to it, I'd always had a British passport, and I came to rugby school in England at the age of, I was just 13 at the time. And when I was brought up, we were brought up to take our greatness as a nation for granted. We loved the United Kingdom. We were the good guys in all the movies. Some Hollywood movies don't paint us very well, but all our own movies, we're the good guys and the Germans are the bad guys, you know. And I understood that and I grew up understanding that. And I took the nation for granted. And I woke up, I suddenly woke up, Rebecca, in 2019 when I became, you know, very engaged in politics, becoming an MEP, a member of the European Parliament for the Brexit Party to try and get us out. And I, like so many people, I was peeling back the onion of politics and realized how awful the situation was. And And it was in the peeling back of that onion that I also suddenly recognized that Farage isn't the answer. Reform is a problem. And so I've set up Advance UK, and we're only 3 months old, but in 3 months, we've become the seventh largest political party in the United Kingdom, and there are dozens and dozens of parties. We've now got 37,000 members, which by American standards is probably quite small, but you know, we're a small country. That's quite a seismic impact we've already made. We are now going about what I regard as the very serious business of producing the policies required to save this country. And we're going to produce the legislation, the draft legislation required to enact those policies. We're going to go right to the point like Trump did, you know, when he turned up with his 100 executive orders on day one. We're going to go into Parliament on day one with our legislative framework absolutely 100% ready, thump it down on the table and say, right, we are in government. This is what we're doing. We've got the democratic mandate. We're doing it. And we're going to be very open with the British people because we would have drafted this legislation. They'll know exactly what it is that we stand for. So we will have that crucial democratic mandate that I was talking about earlier, you know, which I think is fundamental to settling this country. And the challenge we've got between now and 2029, when the next election is, or next election is meant to be, is to connect with the British people. And I've got headwinds, Rebecca, because the establishment don't like us. They regard us. I mean, it's bizarre. I've been an institutional person all my life. I went to a British public school. I went to Cambridge. I worked in the city. I set up my own listed business. I'm governed, regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. I have all the trappings of an institutional person, and I'm not a rebel, but I love my country, and I realize drastic action is now needed to save the country, you know, which you mentioned you visited, you know, earlier on in your life and was so different to the one you're in now. And so the establishment's trying to shut me down. Even channels, you may not know them, but channels like GB News, which are meant to be on our side, and Talk Radio, which are meant to be on our side, have shut me down because they want Farage as Prime Minister. And so the challenge I've got is connecting with the British people. And podcasts like this, if I can call this a podcast, are brilliant because it's my route to speak. It's how I connect. But we've also got this 37,000 members. And that's enough in the UK to fight a general election. Already, we've got enough to fight a general election. And we're going to be mobilizing on the ground. We are already mobilizing on the ground right across the UK to get our message out through leafleting, through door knocking, through Facebook campaigns, through other social media campaigns, making speeches right across the country, recruiting other great people into the party who can go and make speeches as well. And we're just gonna absolutely pepper the country with Advance UK until they know who we are.
Let me ask you, this is a little bit of a point of disagreement between Rick and I on some of the free speech issues. So, point well taken about the sort of policing of speech, curtailment of speech. But then, you know, on the other hand, and maybe this isn't directly contradictory, you know, some of us saw some of the demonstrations that occurred on October 7th. And some of the rhetoric, some of the language, some of the behavior in public spaces, and you say, "What's going on here? Where are the police? You know, where is some sense of law and order? Where is some sense of a state, right? Of a and you might say that, all right, these are things you're seeing on social media, whatever. But I think especially
No, I think
British Jews.
you're calling it absolutely
A
spot
lot of
on.
British Jews aren't worried about free speech. They're worried about that England feels unsafe for them, right? So
Yeah.
how do you are those two different parts of the same broader malaise or crisis, or how do you kind of sort out the kind
Yeah.
of speech issue legitimate with this sense of a
Yeah.
growing disorder, violence, hate,
Yeah.
on the other hand?
You're spot on. They're two symptoms of the same problem. And the essential problem that we've got in the UK, I'll come to free speech again in a second, but the essential problem with these marches that you're referring to is mass migration from cultures that are antithetical and often anti-British at their heart, which is why it's so important for us to reconnect with our Christian constitutional roots and our Christian cultural roots. that we don't allow those to be set aside. Because in the pursuit of progressive discrimination, not only have we taken in these antithetical ideologies and religions into the country, we've then put a protective blanket around them. I'm sure you're familiar with diversity, equity, and inclusion, which effectively is the regulatory mechanism by which minorities are given protection. And that's just discrimination, by the way. There's no way I think you get to an equal, there's no way you get to equality through discrimination. You just can't do it. Even if your intentions were good, you can't progressively discriminate to get to equality. But the more sinister impact of progressive discrimination and putting this protective blanket around people is that they are able to practice their ideologies and their belief systems without any impunity, without any checks and balances on them. And indeed, they're encouraged to do it. But there's an even more sinister impact, and it's this. Our Jewish community, for example, falls into the same protected status that our Muslim community falls into. And if you put a protective blanket around Jews and Muslims at the same time, they're notionally protected from the majority because of that protective blanket, the majority being, you know, white Christian indigenous people, for want of a better way to describe them. They're protected from the majority, but they're not protected from each other because there are no protections afforded to the Jewish community against any other constituent member of the broader protected status that minorities have. Does that make sense? So if you have a significant minority that is muscular and anti-Jewish being protected, it will run ragged when it comes to the Jewish community in the United Kingdom. We have 5 million Muslims in the UK. It was 4 million in the 2021 census. I'm absolutely certain it's about 5 million now. And many of those Muslims are anti-Jewish. They channel their anti-Semitism through their ostensible, I'm not saying everyone who supports peace in Gaza is basically anti-Semite. I'm not going to say that, but there's a significant number of people who channel their anti-Semitism through the promotion of Palestine. It's the vehicle that they use for it. And the Jews effectively in our country have become targeted by these people. And there's no mechanism for our criminal justice system to step in and make sure this doesn't happen, because our criminal justice system is also hijacked by diversity, equity, and inclusion. So that we won't challenge the pro-Palestinian marches when they are saying things that are inherently an incitement to violence against other minorities in our country. And the other thing I'd like to say before I finish on this is that when they target the Jewish minorities in this country, when our criminal justice system isn't prepared to stand up for them, actually they're standing against the United Kingdom. The United Kingdom itself is being attacked because it is antithetical and against our value system, our culture, our great old British way of life to be like that. And now coming to your freedom of speech point, the language used on these marches, and I've been to one march, and I watched it because I needed to experience what was going on. The language being used is an incitement to racial hatred. It's an incitement to violence, and we don't stamp down on that, but we'll stamp down on journalists. I think Tommy Robinson came out and he said, F Hamas, F Palestine, F Islam. And he was arrested for that. You know, so we've got this, we're infected, and we have to go back to this pre-Tony Blair era somehow from a constitutional perspective before we can address all of this. And we do also need to deal, as I said, you know, with mass migration and multiculturalism, progressive discrimination, et cetera.
We have to close, yeah. But I could spend all day. I also didn't get to ask you my burning question about how you feel about Meghan Markle. But we'll save that for offline.
Benabib, thank you so much for joining us, and good luck to you. And we'll be following you from here, and hope to talk to you again soon.
Thank you for having me on.